it's Friday, January 14th. That new rule from OSHA? More like NOSHA. We start here. President Biden's goal to have federal COVID mandates in the workplace just got rejected by the Supreme Court.
The court has now removed a really important tool from the federal government's arsenal.
What the ruling means for businesses and their workers. There have been arrests for the January 6th attacks, but not like this.
Stuart Rhodes never stepped foot inside of the Capitol.
A prominent militia organizer is being accused of sedition. And thousands of student loans just evaporated.
This is the tip of the iceberg when we're talking about the problems facing people with student loans.
But some are asking if a $2 billion settlement should get a passing grade. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey.
I feel extreme confidence and the safety and the efficacy of this vaccine. And I want to encourage everyone who has the opportunity to get vaccinated so that we could have a veil of protection over this country that would end this pandemic.
Since COVID-19 vaccines were made available, the ongoing debate has been, how exclusively do you focus on vaccines as the solution? Because on one hand, we know these shots are safe. We know they work. A new study yesterday estimated that in just the last 18 months, vaccines have saved nearly 250,000 lives in the U.S. alone. But when you tell everyone vaccines are the difference maker, that leaves you open to some vulnerabilities, such as a variant that evades these vaccines a little bit easier. The other issue with vaccines is they're harder to mandate.
What makes it incredibly more frustrating is that we have the tools to combat COVID-19, and a distinct minority of Americans, supported by a distinct minority of elected officials, are keeping us from turning the corner.
You remember last year when President Biden announced a sweeping new rule change saying every large business in the country would now have two options: either pay for a big testing regimen, make sure your employees are safe, or mandate COVID vaccinations for your workers. Get the info on whether they're vaccinated and then act accordingly. Well, yesterday, in a decision that landed with a thud in Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that OSHA policy is dead.
The conservative majority saying OSHA does not have the authority to enforce a vaccine or testing rule for large companies.
ABC Supreme Court contributor Kate Shaw starts us off this morning. Kate, you kind of predicted this might happen when you heard the arguments. Why?
Well, Brad, this is a very conservative Supreme Court, and they are skeptical of federal authority. And that came through loud and clear in the arguments just last week. And you saw it on display in the opinion, 6-3, striking down the OSHA policy, which, as you said, wasn't actually a vaccine mandate. It was a vaccine or test and mask mandate. And yet the first sentence of the opinion described it as a vaccine mandate for much of the nation's workforce.
Polio, but it was a terrible scourge on this country for many years. We have vaccines against that, but the federal government through OSHA, so far as I know, and you can correct me, does not mandate every worker to receive such a vaccine.
The justices found that OSHA lacked the authority under the law to mandate a vaccine for, 80+ million American workers.
Was their argument about the vaccine specifically or everything? Like, you can't mandate any of this.
Honestly, Brad, a lot of this opinion felt like an outcome searching for a justification.
How are we to decide when an emergency temporary standard?
The federal government is going agency by agency as a workaround to its inability to get Congress to act.
The basic thrust of the court's reasoning was that the agency here, OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, is an agency that's supposed to regulate the workplace. But because COVID isn't a threat that is specific to the workplace, the justices found, the agency lacked the authority to issue a rule that mandated either vaccines or testing. It's a little bit of a tricky justification to get your head around, honestly. It's not clear, to me anyway, why the fact that COVID is a threat outside of the workplace, as well as in the workplace, removes an agency's authority to regulate what it does have authority to regulate, which is the workplace. And yet that's what the 6-3 majority of the court found.
And so what does that mean functionally starting today? Like, can companies do whatever they want? They can test, they cannot test, they can vax mandate, they cannot vax mandate?
As a matter of federal law, yes, of course, states and localities can impose their own restrictions and regulations. The court went out of its way to make clear that other government entities might have authority to regulate here, but this sweeping federal policy is now off the table.
It's kind of hard for me to say it should be mandated because I feel in this country people should have that choice. If it's mandated and they don't want to, what's going to happen? Are they going to get fired? That wouldn't be cool.
The federal government could try to issue a more narrow kind of mandate. One of the problems that the majority saw with this OSHA rule was that it didn't make distinctions between different categories of workers. And of course, some workplaces are more dangerous as a matter of COVID transmission than others. For example, you know, the court said, well, the fact that, you know, landscapers, many of them are subject to this requirement, even if they're spending most of their workday outside, the court found sort of undermined the strength of the rule. So it's possible the federal government could try to go back to the drawing board and craft something narrower.
What about hospitals and healthcare workers? Because that was a different rule that the court was also examining at the same time, right?
That's right. And so the court actually allowed this rule to go into effect. So this was a rule that was different from the OSHA rule. This was a rule that actually was a vaccine mandate, so not a testing or vaccine mandate, for workers in healthcare facilities that treat Medicare or Medicaid patients. So basically, they get federal funds and treat vulnerable populations. Individuals who work in those facilities are required under this new policy to be vaccinated, and the court upheld that policy. Then the court also said, look, it's actually really common as a matter of state law for healthcare workers to have to be vaccinated. And so this isn't breaking new ground in the way the court seemed to think this sweeping OSHA mandate was.
Yeah, that hospital ruling, that was 5-4. You had Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Brett Kavanaugh joining the liberals here. That is kind of a win for the Biden administration, but a big loss when you're talking about this OSHA rule that President Biden said would be the difference maker in making sure workers across the country were safe, at least at big companies. Kay Shaw, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, the DOJ said more arrests were on the way. Well, they kept that oath. January 6th prosecutions kick up a notch after the break. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November. And while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, right as the Supreme Court was smacking down the Biden administration on judicial grounds, the president was getting roughed up politically by a fellow Democrat.
While I continue to support these bills, I will not support separate actions that worsen the underlying disease of division infecting our country.
This was Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema telling the world, there's no way I'm going along with the president's plan to revamp the filibuster. Keep in mind, this is as President Biden is on the way to the Capitol to try to whip up support in the face of Republican opposition to a new voting rights bill.
I hope we can get this done. The honest to God answer is, I don't know whether we can get this done.
Well, here she is, basically slamming the door in his face. But as last January 6th showed, even clear election results aren't necessarily immune from being subverted. And as this Capitol Hill drama was unfolding yesterday, the Department of Justice was issuing a momentous arrest.
11 members of the Oath Keepers militia group charged with seditious conspiracy, including the group's leader, Stuart Rhodes, arrested in Texas.
You might remember we talked last week about the Oath Keepers with ABC's investigative producer Mike Levine. He talked about the number of militia members who were involved with the insurrection. Well, the leader of the Oath Keepers has now been arrested, and Mike Levine is back with us this morning. Mike, there have been lots of arrests over people storming the Capitol in the last year. You've been saying this arrest is fundamentally different. Why?
Yeah, this arrest is different. Stuart Rhodes never stepped foot inside of the Capitol. The charges that we've seen over the past year or so, right, they've involved charges like assault on law enforcement, obstructing an official proceeding, you know, illegally entering the Capitol, or some sort of conspiracy related to those types of charges. But with this arrest, the charge is seditious conspiracy. The government is alleging that this was sedition, that the people charged here were actually trying to usurp the government through force.
You've got deep state controlled judges. I would consider Roberts one of them. You've got deep state controlled puppets all through the media.
So Stuart Rhodes is the founder of the Oath Keepers. He started it back in 2009, right after President Barack Obama took office.
Oath Keepers is an association of current serving and former military police and firefighters, all of us who swore an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
You know, he has an eye patch. He's actually a Yale law graduate who now bases much of his rhetoric on what others say is a total misinterpretation of the law.
Here, look, the secrets that the deep state holds on people, all the pedophile stings, all the sex prostitution stings, all of this is how they control everybody.
And this, here's a quote that I wanted to lay out from the indictment. It says that, quote, some members of the Oath Keepers believe that the federal government has been co-opted by a secret group of elites actively trying to strip Americans of their rights. So that's the type of rhetoric that Stuart Rhodes has been associated with since he founded this group back in 2009.
The leader of the Oath Keepers has been arrested in Little Elm. This afternoon, we saw federal agents collecting evidence at a home there.
When he was arrested yesterday, Rhodes was supposed to have a virtual interview with the January 6th investigators in the House, and Rhodes and his lawyer were on the phone prepping for that interview when the FBI called Rhodes on his phone and told him to come outside with his hands up so he could be arrested. Rhodes then added his lawyer into the call, and the three of them, the FBI, Rhodes, and his lawyer, discussed how Rhodes could come out and be taken into custody, and that's how the arrest happened.
Well, and you were telling us last week, Rhodes did not go in the Capitol. That's been his defense, is, you know, I didn't go in, and I disagree with anyone who did go in. So, I mean, what is he alleged to have done that would add up to sedition?
So the government, in the indictment that's been released, they say that this really started in November, certainly in December, right? After the election, after Joe Biden had been projected the winner.
It's all going to come to fruition on January 20th. And between now and then, my hope and expectation is that the American people do know and do understand that there has been a transition.
Stuart, can you not feel history happening right now? I mean, it's happening right now.
It is. And we all need to realize that we're Americans. We're born in this country at this time for this purpose.
There is a lot of detail about how various Oath Keepers members were communicating leading up to January 6th and talking about how they had to go there.
According to the indictment, 2 days after the election, Oath Keepers founder Stuart Rhodes allegedly messaged followers, "We aren't getting through this without a civil war."
And how they had to bring weapons and how they needed to be prepared to do what needs to be done to stop Joe Biden from being certified as the president.
And days later writing, "We must now do what the people of Serbia did when Milosevic stole their election, refuse to accept it, and march en masse on the nation's capital."
In text messages and communications, encrypted communications with members of the Oath Keepers who've been charged along with him in this alleged conspiracy, Stuart Rhodes talks about how they're going to set up what he calls quick reaction forces outside of D.C. These are Oath Keeper members that came from Arizona, Florida.
Rhodes has denied urging the group to storm the Capitol, but prosecutors said he and others made plans to bring weapons to the area to support the operation.
The indictment details how Stuart Rhodes allegedly spent more than $15,000 on firearms just for himself and related equipment.
"I know how you feel, but go home and go home in peace."
On the afternoon of January 6th, court documents say Rhodes told the group, "All I see Trump doing is complaining." He went on to say, "So the Patriots are taking it into their own hands."
So if this represents a turning point in the prosecutions of January 6th, if this is a turning point in how the DOJ is thinking about this now, not just as trespassing on government property or even violence, but sedition, what's next for this investigation?
Well, I think, you know, we sort of touched on this.
But I think this shows that federal authorities are looking at people when it comes to January 6th who, again, never stepped foot in the Capitol and how they may have contributed to what happened on that day. You know, it's hard to know for certain where we go from here, but certainly authorities will be looking at anyone that they think was in touch with these people, you know, with Stuart Rhodes, and how that may have contributed to what happened on January 6th.
Yeah, and I guess the question will be, could you see charges brought against other militia members, other organizers? Could you even see members of the Trump administration or anyone, whether they were wearing a suit or not, who is seen to have been inciting this, what the DOJ clearly sees as an attempted overthrow of democracy? Mike Levine, thank you.
Thank you.
Earlier this week, we talked about allegations that top universities have colluded to reduce the amount of financial aid they give out. You could feel the rage on Twitter of students and former students who feel like they've been taken advantage of every step of the way.
We were told that college was necessary for success, but then we graduated from college, came out with more education than our parents, made less than our parents, and had twice the debt burden as our parents.
Well, if that wasn't enough, yesterday, the student loan company Navient announced it was canceling nearly $2 billion worth of student loans for tens of thousands of students. This was not because it was an act of charity. This was the result of a huge settlement with more than a dozen states who say these students were victims of a scheme.
Student borrowers already facing financial hardships were simply driven further into debt.
Josh Mitchell is the author of one of the year's most acclaimed books, The Debt Trap. And Josh, you've studied the entire student loan industry. First, can you just explain what happened here?
Right. So Navient was an arm of Sallie Mae, and these have to do with loans that Sallie Mae extended to students in the early 2000s to attend for-profit colleges.
Fortunately, my lender paired me with Navient. Their team helped me find a plan to stay on my path.
Basically, Sallie Mae had arrangements with for-profit colleges that if these colleges steered students to take out Sallie Mae loans, then Sallie Mae would allow these students to borrow more to pay tuition at these schools. So it helped both the schools and Sallie Mae.
I think what we're grappling with really is the predatory nature of debt.
Now, the allegations here are that Sallie Mae knew that a lot of these schools had sketchy track records that were not going to graduate these students to help them get good jobs, and that a lot of these students had bad credit. And so basically, they were destined to default on these loans. That's one of the allegations here, that basically Sallie Mae was being a predatory lender, putting people in loans that they knew they were going to default on.
Knowing they default because A, they didn't have great track records with money, and B, these degrees are not like they didn't think the degree might be worth enough to actually help them pay that back later.
Right. There's also another allegation here, which is that when students were repaying their loans, a lot of these students got into trouble in terms of being able to repay them. They were defaulting on them. And so they would go to Navient and say, what can I do so that I can stay on top of my loans? And the allegation here is that Navient said, oh, just go into forbearance, which is basically a way of saying you can put your loans on pause.
Forbearance sounds great because it's zero payment. Everybody loves that. But the problem with forbearance is that it's just increasing the balance.
Now, students have the option to do this, but it's not always the best option because you put your loans on pause and the interest accrues. And so that's what Navient is being accused of doing here.
Navient chose not to disclose or talk through with those borrowers when those borrowers called for help.
Just really quickly saying, hey, go into forbearance, no problem at all. And the student thinks, okay, great. And then they see months after the fact that their balance has risen by thousands in some cases because of interest.
63% of borrowers who made payments with Navient during the COVID forbearance still owe more now than they originally borrowed.
They're accused of two things: deceptive lending on the front end, and then not doing enough to help students get into the best repayment plan on the back end.
And so as part of the settlement, Navient doesn't actually have to admit they did anything wrong, right? They're all still saying this was based on unfounded allegations. They did have to fork over a ton of money, or I guess forgive a ton of debt. So who does not have to pay their bills now? Like, who are these students that get forgiveness?
These loans are going to be canceled. Mm-hmm. So basically, Navient has to eat the losses here. Now, it's important to know that these are mostly private loans, meaning this was not part of the federal student loan program. And so therefore, its investors, the company itself, Navient, which took ownership of the loan, they're going to suffer the losses here.
Well, and so you mentioned how, like, all the intertwinedness can get so confusing. Sallie Mae becomes all these companies. Navient ends up doing the settlement after doing its thing for years. What does this mean, not just for Navient, but for, like, colleges at large who are all dealing with students on student loans?
So this is the tip of the iceberg when we're talking about the problems facing people with student loans. What's ironic here is this. I was looking at the press release from the New York Attorney General last night to look at what Sallie Mae was accused of. And there was this line that said, Sallie Mae knowingly made loans to students that they knew were going to default on the loans because of the schools they attended and because of the credit because they had bad credit. The federal government does that every single day.
Americans owe more than $1.7 trillion in student loans. That's more than credit cards and auto debt.
This isn't a conversation of like, well, it doesn't really work very well. Like, it clearly doesn't work.
It gives loans out to people that have very bad credit, going to schools that often don't have a good record of graduating students and getting them good jobs.
So you're saying there's a problem with, like, the concept of student loans sometimes more than just a company?
Right. That's what I'm saying is that, you know, so what Sallie Mae is accused of doing is something that the broader Education Department federal loan program does every day. And I think we are starting to see as a society in Congress what the repercussions of that loose lending is.
Roughly 1 in 5 borrowers are in default, and the challenges are even worse for students of color. This is unsustainable.
A lot of people were defaulting on their loans before the pandemic and the student loan pause came into place, and they're trying to figure out what do we do.
Right, but then that makes me wonder, if you're pointing out how this is endemic to so many students across the country, how they all feel this crushing debt that they can't afford to pay off, whether that was noticed by lenders or not, are we going to see some sort of much wider forgiveness program from the government?
Yeah, so as of now, I don't think anything is going to happen. I just based on reading the tea leaves and seeing what's happened so far. That being said, what I find interesting is that basically since the pandemic and all the way through this spring, students who have student loans have been allowed to not make payments each month. That will have been more than 2 years that people will have not made payments. And it does raise the question, what happens if there's another downturn? What happens if there's another crisis after the pandemic? Is Congress just going to implement another pause? So I think that there's this really big, broad existential question facing the student loan program right now, which is the government going to continue to just give everyone a blank check? And then what happens on the back end when people go years without making a payment?
And when you look at a country that now has 1 million less college students than it did at the beginning of the pandemic, we've seen how this has kind of shriveled up the number of students in the college system. Josh Mitchell, author of the book The Debt Trap, thank you so much.
Yeah, sure. Thanks.
All right, one more quick break. When we come back, is it too soon to cancel a debate 2.5 years from now? One last thing is next.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
And one last thing.
And what about fracking?
All right, let me allow Vice President Biden to respond.
I never said I oppose fracking.
Could this be the end of presidential debates?
Show the tape. Put it on your website.
I'll put it on.
Put it on the website.
Yesterday, kind of buried in the news about the Supreme Court and January 6th, we learned the Republican National Committee is planning a rule change in which it won't allow the Republican nominee to participate in the big traditional final debates.
Tonight's debate is sponsored by the Commission on Presidential Debates. It is conducted under health and safety protocols designed by the Commission's health security advisor.
Unlike the primaries, these debates are run by the nonpartisan Commission on Presidential Debates, and the RNC was furious with that commission in 2020 over some rule changes because of COVID, in a year where many votes were already being cast before the final debate had aired.
A debate initially scheduled for tonight was canceled after the president's COVID-19 diagnosis.
President Trump rejecting the debate commission's decision to make it a virtual debate.
Since then, the RNC has asked for assurances about who gets to make decisions and when.
There are Republicans on that commission, and that decision was made in part due to health concerns because of lack of disclosure.
Well, they're not nonpartisan Republicans. Those Republicans have been very critical of this president.
They basically challenged the idea that anyone who's been critical of President Trump in the past should be allowed a role in proceedings, which usually would not matter that much. The commission deals with campaigns, not parties. So if both candidates agree, sorry, parties, they're going to do the debates. But one of the side effects of the Trump years is that this RNC is now run by Trump loyalists, meaning if they say they're done with these debates, that means if Trump runs again, he's probably done with them too. So what would a world without these final debates look like?
I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience.
For years, televised debates have offered some iconic moments.
Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
In an increasingly polarized country, there's a case to be made they matter less than ever. Like, who's actually making up their mind in October based on some zinger they just heard?
Putin, from everything I see, has no respect for this person.
Well, that's because he'd rather have a puppet as president of
no
the United
puppet,
States.
No puppet.
And it's pretty clear.
You're the puppet.
It's pretty
but we have seen meaningful polling shifts as a direct result of these debates. Often just a point or two, but Al Gore would remind you that can be all you need. The commission says it's still planning on fair, neutrally run debates in 2024. But if we just saw the final presidential debate of the modern era, it's been quite a ride. So the Democrats might be done with the Iowa caucuses. Republicans might be done with just debating their ideas live on television. Buckle up for 2024. Start Here is produced by Kelly Therese, Brenda Salinas-Baker, Lewis Millman, Madeline Wood, David Toledo, Jen Newman, Vika Aronson, and Tara Gimbel. Ariel Chester is our social media producer. Josh Cohan is our podcast manager. I'm our managing editor. Liz Alessi is our executive producer. Thanks to Lakia Brown, John Newman, Elizabeth Russo, and Stacia Deshishku. Special thanks this week to Chris Berry, Kevin Ryder, Sarah Kolonowski, Micah Cohen, Kurt Villarosa, and Avery Harper. I'm Brad Milkey. See you next week.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.